This is Sunday Night at the TSO. I'm Kathleen Kajioka. Back in 2011, I was in Iceland visiting my family, and my uncle, who's always eager to expose me to Icelandic artists, took me on a little road trip to an artist retreat built at an old farm outside of Reykjavik. There was a piano recital being given by a young Icelander for an audience of about 30 people, and in walked this tall young man who clearly had a way with the audience. His chats between pieces were met with animated responses. Unfortunately, I couldn't participate because it was all in Icelandic, but no matter, because the music spoke for itself. His Bach had a satisfying clarity that I'd rarely heard, and his Chopin was wonderfully colorful and fluid with a glow to the sound that was a joy to listen to. We spoke briefly afterwards, and he told me of his affection for Toronto owing to his admiration for Glenn Gould. And a year later, when he was here, I invited him to be my guest on Dinner Classics, where he spent a whole episode sharing his story and his love of music, which included a hot tip to give a good listen to Glenn Gould's Brahms, one I've never forgotten. Now, this is my I knew him when story, because since then, Víkingur Ólafsson has become one of the most celebrated pianists worldwide. His recordings for Deutsche Grammophon, in addition to gaining over 400 million streams, have won almost every award there is. He's sought after everywhere, so much so that it's not an easy feat to book him for an interview these days. But I'm happy to say we've done it, and he joins me now to talk about his return to Toronto to play Mozart with the TSO. Víkingur Ólafsson, welcome to Sunday Night at the TSO.
Thank you, Kathleen. Really happy to connect with you here again, and really can't wait to come to Toronto. That's going to be exciting.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, congratulations on all of your successes. It has been such a pleasure to witness and so well-deserved. The last time I saw you in person, actually, you were about a month out from recording your Bach album. And I remember you saying it was going to be something a little bit different, and there was a hint of trepidation as to how it would be received. Well, Gramophone Artist of the Year, BBC Music Magazine Album of the Year, among others, an explosion of accolades which hasn't stopped. How is this for you? What is it like to meet with this much positive response to your work?
Well, the funny thing is that, I don't know, in the way the higher you fly on the career front, the more reviews you get and the more the noise becomes. And I'd say that, you know, the vast majority, 90% of the reviews are very, very positive. But 5% are so-so, and then 5% are really negative. So the interesting thing about the human condition is that once you start reading all these reviews, the only things that you actually take are the super negative ones. Because the very positive ones and all the awards and all this stuff, you take that for granted immediately as soon as it happens. It's a little bit like Schopenhauer, that human condition is sort of instinctively goes towards self-doubt and sort of sadness. So I actually stopped following all the noise and don't think too much about all that stuff. I try to sort of stay with the music, and that is, I think, the only way it can function.
Well, speaking of music, we are really looking forward to your return to the TSO with Mozart's C minor piano concerto. You're a musician with wide-ranging tastes and facility, and I'm wondering where Mozart sits for you. What kind of zone do you get into for his music?
Wow, I mean, this concerto in particular, but all of Mozart, more or less, especially late Mozart, you know, appeals to me. I mean, the C minor concerto, it's a very specific work of art, and to me, it sort of combines three times. You have the first movement that, you know, it's perhaps the first sort of romantic piano concerto movement. Not romantic in the sense that it sounds like Chopin, it certainly does, and it's very much Mozart, but it opens up new ideas for what a concerto can be. And this was, I believe, Beethoven's favorite concerto of Mozart's, and you really hear the kind of Sturm und Drang and the kind of sort of the expansion of the form, and you see the window into the 19th century in this piece. And then the second movement, you have something that's extremely classical on the other hand. If the first movement looks to the future, the second movement rests so beautifully in the here and now, in this, you know, exquisite romanza with all this chamber music between the piano, the strings and the woodwinds. And then you have the third movement that's the most radical sort of music that he ever wrote for piano and orchestra, and in a bigger sense, one of the most radical things he actually ever wrote, Theme and Variations. And just from the theme that's just played by the orchestra and not the piano, that it's the most uncomfortable incredible music, you know, full of silences. The silences become the music. Then the piano enters and you have music that really looks back to Johann Sebastian Bach, Mozart's favorite composer, with all this baroque-esque writing, you know, this kind of counterpoint, sometimes bare and naked and uncomfortable counterpoint, actually full of chromaticism. And at one, in one of the variations, the piano solo variation at the very heart of the movement, the piano, he actually goes into church, Mozart. It's almost as if he's in St. Thomas Church in Leipzig on a Bach rendezvous or a pilgrimage, if you wish, you know, and it's just the wildest concerto movement he ever wrote. But this, these three movements together, they form something that it just is unlike any other concerto. And when I played it, and I played it in some of my most important debuts, I did it with the Concertgebouw when I played there first, or the BBC Proms, the Philharmonia. And I like to play this with orchestras because it sort of reminds everyone that Mozart isn't quite the Mozart that we think he is. You know, he isn't the one who is only writing in this kind of classical style. He's not really the one who's just writing music to please us and to delight us. He can also write music that sort of turns the world around. And when he goes into the shadow, he really does go into the shadow. And when you play it with great orchestras and conductors, everybody is reminded as well that, you know, this is perhaps the greatest piano concerto in history. Or, you know, to put it slightly differently, is there a better concerto? I don't think so. Is there a more complete work of art for piano and orchestra? Certainly not. There are a few concertos in the repertoire that can perhaps claim to match this one way or another. Beethoven's Fourth Concerto, you know, Brahms' Second Concerto, these kind of incredible works of art. But for me, the Mozart C minor still has something absolutely, absolutely unique about it.
The last time you were here to play with the TSO, it was with a concerto by a compatriot of yours, Daniel Bjarnason. And in fact, his music will be featured again on the same program. The TSO is giving the world premiere of his Trilogy for Orchestra Part 1. For those who may have missed hearing his concerto, tell us a bit about Bjarnason's music and what makes it compelling.
Yeah, this is exciting. You know, this piece of music, the new one, is the reason why I haven't seen him for months, because he's just been composing and composing and composing. I haven't seen him. So I'm really looking forward to this. I mean, last year, 22, I gave the world premiere of Daniel's third piano concerto with the LA Phil and Esa-Pekka Salonen called Feast. And then we played it a few times. This is a fantastic piece of music as well. Daniel is hard to pinpoint like any other great composer, like Mozart. You know, you can't say that he's one thing or another thing. He's many things simultaneously. And he brings together a lot of different elements in music to form his own voice. I think his music is always very immediate, and it always, from the very first time I hear his works, they usually, you know, get a hold on me, and I remember them, and they live with me immediately. And you know, the more I listen to them, the more I love them, as with any other great music. But yeah, I mean, he's a master, and he writes so well for the orchestra as well. So the orchestras usually love to play his music. They love the way he understands the orchestra. He's a conductor himself. He really knows how to use and to combine the different colors of the different sections and individuals of the orchestra.
Well, that there are two Icelandic talents on one program might have been highly unusual not too long ago. I mean, it once was that the one Icelandic name people knew off the island was Björk, known over here as Björk. But now there is Daniel Bjarnason, there's you, there's Oscar winner Hilde Gunnadottir, there's Anna Thorvaldsdottir, who got name-checked in the movie Tar, there's the BAFTA winner Oliver Arnolds. It's like an Eyjafjallajökull-like eruption of Icelandic sons and daughters onto the world stage. What do you make of this?
Well, it's a wonderful time for Icelandic music. As simple as that. You know, it's a young tradition of, let's say, classical music. And I think Björk has certainly led the way. You know, there's a lot of diversity going on in Iceland, people finding their own paths, perhaps because we don't have that tradition to fall back on. The one thing that I think Björk, who was the first international musician in Iceland, what she's done is she's always asking her own questions, and she doesn't really like to repeat herself in music. You know, her albums are always unique, and they always, each one has its own distinct, you know, character and DNA. And so the names you've mentioned here, Hildur, Anna, Daniel, they are a little bit like that. They're very diverse. You feel they come from the same place still. There's something Icelandic about them, but perhaps what is Icelandic about them is the fact that they are each on their own path that is quite different from what you see around.
Well, that is a nice segue, actually, the whole notion of being on your own path, because while I have you, I must ask you about your most recent Deutsche Grammophon album, From Afar, One recital recorded twice, once on a grand piano, which is what one expects, and then again on an upright piano, which is usually considered at the bottom of the instrument hierarchy. And, you know, but to be honest, if I had to choose, because I have to, my aunt actually sent me the LP, which is great, and I just listened to it again this morning.
That's so sweet.
But yeah, if I had to choose, I love the upright version more. It's so tactile and intimate and revelatory to hear that instrument on its own terms. I'm wondering, like, when you proposed it, did it take some convincing?
Well, I didn't even propose it that much. I mean, I recorded the album first on the grand piano, and then I had the upright there just to play. And it connected to the fact that I had an upright piano in my bedroom and this album when I was growing up. And this album is very much, I'm looking back in time and sort of looking at my roots and looking at my musical upbringing and the musical choices on there. And one way or another, they connect to my past in a deep sense. And I think that, you know, the upright piano was just there in the studio and I started to record one track and then the next track. And then all of a sudden I was just recording the whole album again. I was first just thinking it's nice to have this extra material, you know, when you record today. The company, the record company, and everybody seems to ask for so much extra bonus material. It's just part of the game. And then I had just recorded the whole thing twice. And then I couldn't really decide in the end because I love the upright piano. The way I use it is not like a normal upright piano, but rather with the felt. So, you know, not all of the upright pianos have this function, but some of them have it, like the Yamaha, the Kawais, and a few others. So you press the middle pedal down and sort of put it in a sort of locked position, and then you have this felt that is then lowered and goes in between the hammer and the string. So the sound is just transformed into something so really beautiful, very soft, but you have to play it with extreme contour and nuance to get the results that you want. And my thing with the upright piano was to try to play the instrument, you know, as detailed as I could to try to keep my voice while in this extremely dreamy landscape. So in the end, we couldn't decide, neither me nor the record label, which one to release, the upright or the grand piano version. And then I just said, what tells you that we can't just do both? And didn't take any convincing. They just said, let's do it. It was as simple as that. And now they're just both there in the world. And it's quite nice because the interpretations are somewhat different, actually, from the different requirements and the different responses one has for each instrument. But, you know, that idea of the upright piano is actually, it comes a lot from pop music in a way, and people think I'm taking it from Max Richter or Ólafur Arnalds. But the fact is, before the neoclassical crowd started to use this, and Hollywood certainly a lot, a certain composer named Georgi Kurtak was absolutely obsessed with and is obsessed with the upright piano, with the felt. So he had actually recorded most of his piano recordings in later years on this very instrument. And since From Afar is also dedicated to him and has a lot of his incredibly beautiful piano music, it seemed yet another layer of sort of meaning to release it on both instruments.
Well, it's a fantastic outcome. You have a habit of putting together original recording programs that throw a fresh light on things. I'm wondering what you have up your sleeve next.
Well, I'll just tell you, it's a piece that Toronto knows, the Goldberg Variations, that's coming out.
Whoa.
Oh. And you know what? I'm actually coming to Kerner Hall in Toronto to play those variations next year. It's going to be quite special to play the Goldbergs in Toronto for obvious reasons. But I've just recorded them 2 weeks ago, and I'm still waiting for the first edit. But I've never, I think, in my life prepared quite this much for a recording project, although I always give them my all and really do. I've been thinking about this one for years and practicing for it quite a lot. And, you know, I played the Goldbergs quite a lot years ago, and then I have been resting them for, I think, about 6 or 7 years. And now I came back to them. And then next season, 23-24 winter, I will be doing a world tour of more or less only the Goldberg Variations, sort of giving myself a break from the orchestras and the orchestras a break from me.
Fantastic. Can't wait. You are jetting around the world so much that I have to ask, when you have a chance to go home to Iceland, aside from family and friends, what is it that you're most happy to be reunited with?
My pianos? It's a very good question, actually. I like a place called Krýsuvík, which is about 25-minute drive from Reykjavík. Unbelievably beautiful place. Where I think NASA had its space program training before, you know, they launched their moon mission, the Apollo. because it resembles the moon quite a lot, this territory. I love that place. It's so really beautiful. It's incredibly private. So if I were to name one thing that I love to reconnect with, it's Krýsuvík in Iceland. But I also just like my local Italian, La Primavera, you know, a fantastic restaurant. I just all the usual thing. I like, you know, a certain cafe where I have my flat white, etc. But those are pretty boring answers, I'm afraid. But Krýsuvík is a good answer.
On your arrival in Toronto, I'm wondering, are there any particular pilgrimages that will be on the agenda, aside from obviously rehearsing and performing with the TSO?
Well, last time I was here in Toronto, I went to Glenn Gould's tomb and or grave and paid him my respect. I might do that again now, actually. He's been with me in one way or another for a lot recently. As I just have been revisiting the Goldbergs and thinking about my fascination with his recording. Mine is going to be quite different, of course, but I've just got so much admiration for him. So spend some time with Glenn there. But I think the more I think about the 1955 recording he did of the Goldbergs, the more I'm convinced that this is perhaps the first, this is the first work of art in the studio for classical music. It's the first great studio album, using the full potential of the studio and loving and embracing the process of the studio. Yeah, I don't know any record before 1955 Goldberg that approaches the studio quite like this. I think in this recording, he did more than revolutionize the way we play Bach. He revolutionized the way we can actually think of the studio as a creative sanctuary. Think about it. I mean, the aria that he plays, and he doesn't even repeat it. The first time through, he doesn't do the repeats in the aria. And I think he did more than 20 takes of it. And just that, you know, in 1955 is so strikingly unusual. And he recorded something between 5 and 6 hours of material. And those takes, they're so experimental and they're so interesting. And they're so they just change the way we think about the studio. So the more I think about him being 23-year-old and sort of reinventing the studio, it's a little bit like Frédéric Chopin reinventing piano technique when he was 20 by writing the Etudes in the middle of nowhere in Poland. It's just one of those processes in music history that won't be repeated and is so immensely important.
How do you approach the studio? I mean, you're a wonderful concert artist, wonderful studio artist. It must be a different headspace. How do you embrace that space?
Well, I have my motto in the studio: love the process, trust the process. It has to be full of freedom. And at this point in time, I choose to record over more days, but fewer hours a day. You know, I used to do albums in 3 days, just spending 10 hours at the piano every day. I don't believe in that anymore. I don't like it because I find that after 4 or 5 hours of studio work, I don't have the same level of inspiration for the music that I have in the morning. So now the Goldberg Variations, I recorded over 5 days, I think. And that was maybe 2 hours in the morning, 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and that's it. But I think you have to know yourself, know the studio, know yourself psychologically, and know when things go wrong in the studio and you're not playing your best, to trust it and love it all the same and embrace it and allow it to be, take a break, come back and trust the process and love the process. It's the most human thing, and the pressure we put on ourselves. I mean, when you go into the studio, when I go into the studio, I have one goal, which is to do the best recording in history. And I will never, of course, realize that goal, and I'm far away from it, but that is what I want. And that is, I believe, what everybody should hope for when they go into the studio. They should look for their ideal and what they believe is the ideal for this music at this point in time. And of course, that changes over time. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a megalomaniac, and I realize I'm really far away from achieving this, but it's still there somewhere in the back of your mind. And it has to be. And that's why you have to prepare so madly for those recording sessions to try to reach that ideal. But of course, then endless things work against you. You know, the piano has problems, the bench has problems, there's ticking noise in the hall, and then all of a sudden you just lose your inspiration. I mean, a million things happen somehow. Things that you thought were easy when practicing become incredibly hard in the studio. This one note always sticks out, the piano technician can't fix it. You know, it's like full of things that people don't realize. This string has a little bit of buzzing sound, so we have to stop everything for 2 hours while we try to get rid of the buzzing so that it doesn't bother us in the post-production. It's crazy process, and since I'm such a perfectionist with it, I don't let anything go. I think you have to, in a way, have two sides. You have to be a crazy idealist and want to do the best thing that's ever been done, and certainly your best work. And at the same time, you have to somehow love your failures and embrace them and allow them to be and accept yourself as you are. Meanwhile, it's very contradictory, but I think it has to go hand in hand.
Víkingur Ólafsson, such a pleasure to speak with you as always. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to hearing you in Toronto.
Thank you, Kathleen. I'm really looking forward to returning to Toronto Symphony.